Welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms, through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Welcome to our show. My name is Deborah Rose, and I'm your host on Circle Talk. Circle Talk is one of the shows featured on CSNP, Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast. CSNP has a lineup of rotating shows throughout each month. Mondays feature Lunatic Mondays with host Laura Gonzalez. It can't be Tuesday without Circle Talk, and I continue to be the host for this fun discussion show on the first and third Tuesday of each month. Wednesdays features none other than Selena Fox with her show, Circle of Nature. The second and fourth Fridays of each month features Songs of the Pagan Tribe, hosted by Kern Greenman. Let's talk more pagan music, exploring the songs, people, and the wonderful, inspiring world of pagan music. The third Fridays of each month features Blue Marble, an eco-educational, eco-restorational, and eco-spirituality podcast that features activist adventures, stories about climate impacts with climate solutions, and how you can manifest good energy for the planet. Would you like to celebrate the full moons with folks? Then come celebrate the next full moon online with Circle Sanctuary Community. The theme is Springtime Rising and takes place on Monday, March 25th. Full moon circles begin at 7 p.m. Central Time, which is 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Mountain, or 4 p.m. Pacific. Circle Sanctuary full moon circles include invocations, music, meditations, poetry, reflections, and ritual workings. They are facilitated by Circle Sanctuary ministers, Reverend Selena Fox and Reverend Judith Sizes, plus other members of the Circle Sanctuary community. Those joining online are invited to bring a candle to kindle during the ritual and are invited to interact with others on chat on YouTube. Attendance is free and no registration is required. For more information, please go to circlesanctuary.org. Hades is one of the most recognizable yet misunderstood Greek gods. Tonight on Circle Talk, we will be exploring through myth, storytelling, and practical exercises, how Hades is more than just a keeper of the souls and the land of the dead. Author Jamie Wagner will be discussing her new book, Hades, Myth, Magic, and Devotion, which will reveal his true nature and provide everything needed to create your own Hades devotional practice. Jamie is a pagan priestess, philosopher, writer, and teacher. She co-founded the Way of the Weaver, a gender-inclusive program of magical inquiry, social justice, and community building. Jamie has studied folklore, mythology, and the occult for more than 20 years and has been a devotee of Hades since 2016. For more information, you can visit her on her website, jamiewagner.com. That's JamieWaggoner.com. You can also find her on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at JamieWaggoner. Let's welcome Jamie to Circle Talk. Welcome, Jamie.
Hi, Deborah. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, tell us a little bit how this started. How did this spirituality path start for you? Did you grow up pagan?
No. No, my family is definitely a very conservative Baptist type of family. So when I was in college, I, you know, did a philosophy degree. And for my senior thesis, I was taking a lot of courses that were on feminism and women's history and sort of the intersections of those things. And I became really interested in sort of this, and this was the like mid to late 90s. So sort of the reemergence of like goddess consciousness and sort of all of these sort of goddess traditions and Dianic witchcraft and all of these things that were sort of coming. That were coming to the forefront of that time. And I was really, my interest was academic. And so I just kind of studied all kinds of authors that were kind of out there at that point in time. That would have been like, oh gosh, Carol P. Christ, Starhawk, the woman who wrote Essential Reiki. I can't remember her name right now, but and some others like that, right? So it was like kind of the second wave feminists that were coming out with some of these books on women's spirituality. And in the midst of studying all of that, I just kind of fell in love with the goddess. And
Cool.
my interest became less academic and more of a devotional type of interest. And I feel like my entry point was kind of deeply studying the Bible and really identifying with some of the more feminine people that are in the Bible, like Mary the mother of Jesus or Mary the Magdalene, folks like that. And then that kind of transitioned more into some other goddesses as well. So, and I worked primarily with just goddesses for a large like a large part of my adult life. I would say probably until about 2016 when Hades made an entrance.
I know. And tell our listeners, because I read your book, which is excellent, by the way. And I love the story of how you were kind of introduced. You got the little straw, and it wasn't necessarily something you were excited about at first. I thought that was so charming and very Hades-like after I read your book. So anyway, tell our listeners that story.
Yeah, I love that. You're actually the first person to make that connection out loud. That what happened to Hades kind of happened to me. So in 2016, I was asked to be on the ritual facilitation team for a week-long camp in Vermont. It's a Vermont Witch Camp. It's part of the Starhawk reclaiming tradition. And so we were facilitating rituals all week long, and we were kind of we were tasked with providing sort of a way for people to enter the myth. The theme of the camp was Persephone's descent. So as a team, like in our work that we were doing to prepare before we got on the campground, was we decided to divide up the characters in the story, and each of us would take one person and study them in depth and kind of learn about their energy, learn about their correspondences, so that when we got to camp, we could bring that with us and hopefully kind of bring that to all the different participants that were going to be there. And so the day that we were choosing our lots, as it were, I just kind of waited to last. I let everybody that was there kind of choose first. I kind of thought maybe I would be ch chosen to be Persephone because of my age, right? And the fact that I have a very feminine presentation. I mean, I'm not a young woman, but I'm not, I was the closest one in the age bracket. And actually, we had this lovely transgender individual who like rose her hand and was like, "I want to be Persephone." And all of us were like, "That is fantastic. Let's do that." Like, we were all on board. So it wasn't going to be her. So I just kind of hung out until everybody else had picked, and no one had picked poor Hades. He was like the last kid to get picked for a team, And I mean, I didn't think much of it. I wasn't upset that I just kind of felt sorry. I'm like, well, somebody's got to pick Hades. Like, somebody's got to. And I had already worked with some pretty earthy Chthonic deities. Like, one of the main deities I work with outside of the Greek pantheon, I work with Ceridwen a lot. As many folks might know, Ceridwen is Welsh. She's from the Welsh cycle of mythology. And Arion Road and some other goddesses that were pretty fierce. So Hades didn't really intimidate me too much, but it was kind of a surprise, It was a surprise challenge.
That's really fun. So did I am sad to say I am until I read your book was not very familiar with Hades and probably had a lot of misconceptions. Tell our readers just in a snapshot a little bit about him and his myth and what has drawn you from that to being a devotee.
Yeah, so most people know about Hades because of the Homeric hymn to Demeter. And it's in the story, the inciting event of the story is Hades kidnapping Persephone from a meadow that's in full
One
bloom.
version, yes.
Yeah, so that's what most people know about him. Now, that myth isn't about Hades and Persephone per se. It's actually really more about Demeter, and it's an allegory for like the changing of seasons, right?
Seasons, right.
So Yeah, so Hades is he does not have a central piece of mythology. He's often a secondary or tertiary character in some sort of, or he kind of ducks into a story to make the action progress. It's not, so it's very difficult to find him. And so you kind of have to dig. You have to look at art, you have to look at poetry, you have to look at plays, you have to look at all kinds of different things from ancient Greek and Roman culture to sort of piece together his identity. And the more I, the more I researched and the more I studied and the more time I spent with him in Trance Journey, which is a big part of my own magical practice, I was just really drawn to his personality and the way that he approaches his responsibilities and how steadfast he is in that. And yeah, so it was very surprising. It was very surprising on many levels. Hades is, yeah, he's the third brother, right? So Zeus and Poseidon are his brothers. They're all from the Olympian generation of gods. But Hades himself is not considered an Olympian. He doesn't live on Mount Olympus. He lives in the underworld. And so he is very different from his brothers that interact so much with the land of the living and kind of have like far different concerns, and purviews than he does.
Absolutely. How did you begin working with him? What were some signs that you realized that this was becoming important to you, and how did you start? Like, how did
Well,
he call you?
how did he call me? Well, I think that obviously the witch camp scenario was kind of like the big thing. But when I was at camp, I was actually called upon in multiple rituals. I think I did it three times, because there's rituals all week long. And in the reclaiming tradition, they have a technology that they call aspecting. It's basically like a possessory trance state where you allow like a deity to come into your body and perhaps you use your body, use your voice to interact like within a ritual container so participants
You allow
can
yourself to
interact.
be open. Yes.
Yeah. And so I served as that sort of channel for Hades to come through. And I think I think I was just fooling myself that I would have had any option after that because you get to you're almost like an observer in your own body, but you're observing their interactions with people. And he was just, very, he was stoic but tender. And I know that that seems paradoxical, but it really was. And like the way he treated people with respect, the advice that he offered them, I could also kind of feel his emotions a little bit too, sort of the responsibility he feels, certainly the love he feels for Persephone and the loneliness he feels when she leaves. And so that was really, really, I mean, it was amazing and transformative, but I came home and I was like, I don't know if this fits into my life. Sure. I haven't really worked with more masculine energies or masculine deities since I left the Christian church. And Hades is, and I say this in the introduction, I had to give myself permission to really love him and to work with him for many reasons. He's very misunderstood. There is the myth with Persephone, which is
I was going to say, let's talk
difficult
about the
to
myth.
navigate.
It's funny. Again, as a young woman or as a child growing up, you heard the myth, and the myth was that she was captured against her will and she stayed. Have you ever heard the song Persephone by Mama Gina? It's
Maybe.
wonderful. It is wonderful. And in that myth story, which really changed how I view the myth, for her, Persephone chooses to stay. And she learns that there's many sides to her and that she needs him as much as she needs. And so it's much more of a choice. And so So tell us a little about your take on the Persephone myth, because you did a very good job about talking about that and how it could trigger some people and different aspects of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, as you might have, you and listeners might have gleaned, I am, feminist from the way back. And so I am absolutely not okay with, assault, kidnapping, lack of body autonomy, all of those things. Like, those things are just so against my personal belief system. And, I was really like, how can I love a God that this might be part of his story?
His story.
And it's really interesting. I mean, I go into the book kind of the way that the myth is told, not only in the Homeric Hymn to Demeter, but in subsequent pieces of prose and poetry that other poets of the ancient world wrote as well, and talk a little bit about the words like that are chosen to describe this act, and and how entomology changed over the centuries and how that kind of impacted the way people were seeing the myth. And honestly, I do talk to Persephone when she's in the underworld and I talk to Hades too. And my process for writing this book, each chapter begins with a retelling, like a narrative retelling of a
Myth,
portion of
which is
myth in ha
very good.
in Hades' voice. Yeah. And so I go into trance journey to sort of, communicate with him, like, how would you like me to tell your story now for modern audiences? What do you want to say? And then I try to capture down what he says. And the story of Hades and Persephone, he gave me part of it and she gave me part of it. But I think it's really interesting that in speaking with them, they did not give me a definitive answer, whether there was choice and agency or whether there was not. And what I've come to realize is that, it's millennia since this myth was first written down and first told. And we it, like mul multiple millennia, and we're still talking about it, right? And we still can't figure out what happened. And I think overall, it's very tempting to fall into feminist versions where Persephone has agency, but I think that that maybe bypasses some of the conversations that are important to have to make us
And the
more kind
mystery.
and compassionate humans. Yeah, we're still talking about consent today. We're still talking about body autonomy today. And I think that
Unfortunately,
that's
yes,
actually,
you are. Yes.
yeah, and I think that that's actually a brilliant part of this myth, right? Because we can
Okay.
kind of talk about, we can kind of use the story to lead us into those conversations,
Right.
So yeah, it's that one is complex.
It is. But you do a really good job of introducing it and, as you say, making you think. And yes, it is a good mystery. Like you say, it's been here for millennia and probably always will be. You've talked several times in a book, you talk about the harrowing journey and trance work. And tell us a little bit about that process for people who are not familiar what trance work is, a trance journey, and how you do it.
Yeah, it's Trance Journey is the name that I use for it. I've heard it called many different things. Some people, use the word shamanic journey. Some people use the word spirit flight. Some people, there's different things that you can call it. But basically, it's a way to send your consciousness out into like the other world, a different plane, a different dimension, so that you can actually speak with some of these unseen ones, these unseen beings that we don't normally get a chance to interact with in our waking world. And for me, Trance Journey, I would say, is probably my number one magical tool, like the thing that I absolutely do the most. Not only to get, to talk to deities about story and myth, but also that's how, I'll go into the trance journey realms to talk to some of my guides, right? To talk to their spirits, to ask them questions, to get advice, things like that. You can go there to talk to ancestors and all kinds of things. I go there to get information about plants and animals from kind of the spirit of those plants and animals, right? Because I can't actually talk to my Datura and get an answer back. I mean, I still talk to her, but I don't really get an answer back. But if I go see her in the trance realm, she can possibly potentially speak back to me if she chooses. So, and it's just it's almost like a med it's a meditation technique. So it's very, I mean, everybody can learn to do it. And it's, you know, I actually guide people through like kind of a basic introduction of how to do it safely
do.
And how to come back safely.
So that is so interesting. So I tell us what type of magical practices or that you do. I remember from the book you talk about creating a seasonal calendar for Hades, which is very clever, and I never thought about doing that. So talk a little bit about that. That's very clever.
So, you know, so I think I was influenced by the fact that a lot of Greek and Roman gods and gods in other pantheons and other traditions, such as Catholicism, there are feast days, right? There's feast days for saints, there's feast days for gods and goddesses. And you know, there's not much information about Hades,
right?
and certainly nothing that's pertains to him, just specifically him. Hades, of course, as the consort of Persephone, has some place like in like the mysteries of Demeter and Persephone and things like that that happen seasonally, but there's nothing that's just for him. And so I kind of, you know, just decided for myself, I'm like, well, I think I will do, you know, the feast days. If I want to do a feast day, I do a feast on the equinoxes, right? So the vernal equinox and the autumnal equinox. And the autumnal equinox, I'm in North America, so I'm kind of speaking from my perspective here, is when Persephone returns. So that one's a little bit more celebratory. And, you know, we're coming up on the vernal equinox, which is when Persephone goes back to the land of the living to do what she needs to do there.
And spring comes.
And so that was a little bit more sad, a little more sorrowful, but still good, you know. And then I just tried to think of like, you know, Hades' energies, like what would be, you know, as far as like a calendar of things that you could be working with during the year, like during, you know, while there is a growing season in the summer, you could grow plants and things that are sacred to him, you know, in the middle of the winter when we have much more darkness than light, perhaps that's a time to go into sort of deep meditations with him, right? So I just kind of give some examples of like how you could creatively work that into your life.
Yeah, I think you do a really good job like that. Because like I said, a lot of times books will give people information, but they're not sure how to take that first step and go with it. And you do a really good job of laying it out. Like offerings, talk about that. You give examples of how, when you start to work with Hades, how you can do offerings. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so offerings can range from something really simple to something more elaborate. I think one of the most simple offerings that I, well, actually, I'll start really, really simple. So the most, like, the littlest thing that I do, but still very powerful, is I have a Hades altar in my central hallway of my home, which is right by the staircase. I pass by it all the time. So most of the time when I pass by, I will actually just touch two fingers to my lips and two fingers to like a framed image that I have of Hades on the altar. Just, you know, offering kind of like a little gift of breath or a little gift of a kiss, right? Like, so that's just the tiniest offering. I think that I've identified in the book that a time where a time that really suits Hades' energy during the day is sunset twilight, right? That liminal spot between day and night. And there are a lot of hymns in the book that I wrote. And so I'll oftentimes go outside at sunset twilight and just read one of the hymns, like by way of offering, just to kind of read that. And, you know, then you can move kind of up the scale of things, right? So you can move up to offerings of oil or of food and drink or, you know, other things. It's interesting because for chthonic deities, offerings are usually not like incense, like something that would kind of be lit and go up into the air. Offerings are poured on the ground, or, you know, in the case of, you know, in ancient times, there was actually a hole or a pit that was dug into the ground where the offerings were placed. So that's like a major difference when it comes to, you know, if you're doing something a little more physical than, you know, just reciting a hymn, you know.
That would make sense that you would pour something into the ground for someone who's, you know, the god of the underground. So that would make sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really, but you do a really good job of that. You do, and you have a lot of plants, which in each section, I remember you give lore, and then you talk about that. You give like mythological or sites like rivers and underground, which I found fascinating. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so one of the challenges, like way back in 2016, when I first was called to work with Hades, is finding correspondences. So, you know, if we're magical practitioners, we kind of know a lot about correspondences. We like to, you know, we like to build an altar with corresponding items to draw the energy that we're trying to get there, right? And that was kind of largely like absent for Hades. So I dug into mythology. I did kind of the trance journey to get some of my own like personal gnosis about it. Experimented with some different things, different plants, different crystals, different, you know what I mean? Just different times of day, just kind of to see like what I could learn about them energetically. And so there are 20 plants and 10 animals and 10 actual physical locations around the globe that are associated with Hades in some way or the underworld. So they're kind of associated with either him or with that type of chthonic energy. And I try really, really hard. It's very important to me to cite the primary source of the lore. So the primary source is like as close as we can get to the original, right? So I try really hard, even when it comes to the plants and animals, to you know, cite the primary sources to make the case as to like why this actually makes sense, you know?
And it was interesting because these were not exotic things that I couldn't find in this hemisphere or ancient plants. It was like, I'm trying to remember, mint, mistletoe, rue. I'd never heard of rue water. Tell us about that. That was really exciting. So you get, there were things that were a fig. There were things that were very familiar, which was exciting.
Yeah. I mean, in the ancient world, for the poets and the playwrights that wrote down all these narratives, like everything was magical. Plants were magical. Animals were magical. I mean, anything, everything. It didn't have to be something special or fancy. Rue is actually, it's an herb. It's used to flavor food. It's R-U-E, rue. It's kind of fallen out of favor for our modern palate. Like not a lot of people use it anymore. I think they use it mostly like in probably like in the Mediterranean and North Africa. I think they still use rue. But so the first usage of rue water, I think, is in the early modern period. And it's basically rue tastes bitter. It's a bitter herb. And it was believed that kind of it tastes bad. And because of this bad taste, it can also like prevent spirits and like ghosts and entities that you don't want around you or your home. It can protect against those because they'll kind of come close and they'll kind of get that bad taste of rue in their mouth and that'll make them go away. And it's funny because rue, like this usage of rue actually followed with settlers over to North America. And especially in the Appalachian regions and in some traditions of like root work and hoodoo, rue water is made to this day as like a floor wash for washing down your floors or for putting on, you know, the door, like the doorways of your home or for drawing sacred symbols of protection on your windows, things like that. Yeah, so I included a recipe for making rue water in the book.
I know, that was really fun. And I enjoyed reading about the plants and how they associated. And again, there were rosemary. I mean, there were a lot of common things that I would not have thought. And you did a really good job of helping me correlate that. You talked about your altar. What is on your Hades altar? Again, that would be something that I would not, and I would probably, until I read your book, had no idea what to put on your altar.
Okay. So on my Hades altar, the primary one, the one that I was talking about by the staircase, I'm trying to remember because I can't actually see it out of the corner of my eye, but I think I can remember most of the things. There is actually taking up kind of the, well, there's an image of Hades that is actually on the wall right above the altar, as well as there's sort of a letterpress print of a poppy field. When I went to Italy and I went to the Cave of the Cumaean Sibyl, it was May and there were poppies everywhere. Aww. It was so beautiful. And so it really reminds me of that memory because we made offerings to Hades when we went. And it also, I mean, poppy is one of his sacred plants as well. So that's also on the wall there. And then on the, like, sitting on the shelf of the altar, I have a forged iron bident, which is basically an agricultural tool. It's two-pronged. If you imagine a trident, I think everybody's familiar with a trident. It doesn't have the middle prong. It's like two outside prongs. I have like kind of the four, like the, it doesn't have the staff. It's sort of the bident end of it.
Right.
Which, because that's a symbol of Hades, rulership over his domain. So Zeus has a lightning bolt, Poseidon has a trident, Hades has a bident. And it actually makes a lot of sense because it's an agricultural tool. It's a tool for like breaking up rocky soil. And one of the things that people may not realize is that fertile soil and earth is considered the dominion of Hades. So everything that's under the surface, like under the grass, under the leaf litter,
I did not know that. Yeah.
Hades is considered like the ruler of like fertile earth, of minerals, of rocks, of, you know, all the resources that we find buried in those layers. So the bident's there. I have a very small, it's like an Etruscan reproduction statue of a woman, which is there for for Persephone. There's a hymn. Sitting on the altar, there is there's my token, my underworld token that I use to cross the River Styx and come back, which for me is an owl feather. So the owl feather is sitting there. And there is a variety of crystals. I think I have an amethyst and like a brown tourmaline and I think a smoky quartz. And then I've also got some coins. I've got some of my like euros from the last time I was in Europe that are there. I think that's most of the things.
That's really cool. Tell me.
A cicada shell, like a shed skin of a cicada that I found on my deck. It's like a sacred animal of the underworld. And so I have like the little, you know, the outgrown skin.
Oh,
of the
and
cicada.
That would be a rare and unusual type of offering for him to have because those don't come out all the time. So that's really cool. Yeah. Oh, that's really, that is really cool. And that's something that people can identify with because that's something that usually when people want to start doing something, they want to know how to build an altar and what can I do? Where did you find pictures or art images of Hades? Are there a lot?
There are some. I would just recommend just do an internet search.
Google search,
Just an image search on Google. Also, there's a lot of very good artists like on sites like Etsy or on like Society 6. If you do a search for Hades, you'll find a lot of Hades and Persephone because people really love that. Really love the romance of Hades and Persephone.
Right.
But you'll also find a few that are just him. Yeah.
That's really. Have you met other Hades devotees?
I've met a few. Actually, there are a few that are interviewed in my book that are included in there. And it's interesting because now I'm starting to do like signing events for the book, like in Birmingham and Atlanta. And I'm going to a conference coming up at the end of this week. And it's up in Minnesota. And it's interesting. There are people that are reading it because they're very interested in Hades. And they're like, oh my gosh, there's finally a book about Hades. And I'm like, yes, there finally is. Because it's really a one of a kind thing.
Right.
But I also get a lot of Persephone devotees as well. Like they want to have the book to read about, you know, the being that's important to her. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So this is not your first book though, correct?
It's my first solo book. I have been part of many anthologies. Yeah.
Okay.
I've been part of many anthologies. Yeah. And
so you're doing book tours? How's it going? How do you like that?
It's pretty unbelievable. It doesn't really feel like reality yet, I think. I'm still, I live in a pretty small college town, so I haven't really gone to like a big box bookstore yet to go and look at the paganism section and see if my book's sitting there. I'm sure that's going to be a wild moment. In a former career, I was actually in marketing, and a large part of my job was copywriting. So I've been a writer my entire life. I've written,
So you understand that process.
I don't know how many millions of words I've written over my lifetime, but it's a lot. And but this is my first solo nonfiction project. So this it's not going to be the last. Like I really loved doing it, and I will definitely be writing more. But this book is a dream come true for me.
Oh, that's really cool. Now tell me, I'm always curious about people who are very creative. Are you like when writing this book, did you like set a schedule and an outline and I write these days of the week, or did they just come to you and you wrote on a napkin and at a restaurant? How did the whole creative process be for you?
Well, I took a workshop from a gentleman named Richard Estep, who is a writer and a paranormal investigator. And the workshop was actually on publishing, and because he has, I don't know, I think he's got over 30 books now. Anyway, so he kind of walked us through the process of writing like a pitch and writing an outline and kind of things that publishers are looking for. And so I followed his advice. That worked like a charm. Llewellyn accepted my pitch, and then it was time to write. Okay, so I had an outline, had a very very well fleshed out outline to follow. The book that you have now in your hands is, I would say, somewhat true to the outline. Because you know what happens when you research things and when things are coming together, you start. It kind of like your path sort of diverges. You take little
Right,
trails
you
that you
just
didn't expect
add,
to take, right? Yeah. And so I definitely experienced that. I do, and I actually the research part, I love it so much because I'm so curious. And there was a point when I had to like cut myself off. I'm like, you cannot re you cannot research anymore. Like that's it. Like you can't. Like you just have to put that on the table, save it for next time because
That's fun.
we've got to fill in the chapters and fill in the connections and the transitions and make this body of work available, right? But yeah, I have in my program, I use a program called Scrivener to write. And basically you can set yourself a word count goal for the day. So I, just kind of divided up the time that I had between, when I first got the contract and when I was to deliver a complete first draft. And so basically kind of worked out what word count I needed to hit every day to get it there. And so I will sit down at my laptop and turn on the word count tracker and just go until I meet the
Fun.
goal
I
for
can tell
that
you're a
day.
copywriter. You're very, very disciplined. So anyway, so that's really cool.
And I mean, sometimes it was harder to meet the goal than others, like especially we were talking about the chapter with Persephone. That chapter was I want very much wanted to get it right. So that one was slower than others, right? So I, sometimes I would have a slow day, but then I'd have fast days and it would make up for it.
And that's good that you have a history of writing and that you really, really like to write. I'm always very jealous and envious of people who have that creative spark
Thanks.
and it's fun. It's fun when you read books and books like yours and really good books will give me the words that I had in my head or my heart, but I didn't know what to say. And so it's
Oh,
always
thank
really
you.
excited when you read a book and you're like, oh yeah, that's great. I think this book is great for experienced practitioners, especially those who want to ex go outside the box their comfort zone or the box of the pantheon that they've worked with to explore other things. But I think this book is also really good for kind of beginners. You give some examples of like circle casting and how to ward and how to ground. Tell us a little bit about that. That was a really good. So again, I would recommend this to beginners because there's a lot of things that they immediately could learn and put to practice.
Yeah, so I believe in magic is fun, but also inherently risky. So I believe in trying to be as safe and well-informed as you possibly can. It's never going to be 100%, but you can, do what you can. And so I wanted to, alongside, all of the things about Hades, like the myth and the correspondences and things, I really wanted to give people a way to build a relationship with him if that's what they wanted, right? And so to do that, in a manner that is going to be, kind of safe and productive. Now, it's not just add water, it takes a while, but to build that up. So that's why I give sort of, how do you purify yourself or a space? How do you consecrate an altar? How do you, why do you work with correspondences? What
Well,
does
your
that even
grounding
mean?
examples were really good. The process
Yeah.
about
Oh, thank
grounding
you.
was very good.
Yeah. How do you ground yourself? How do you know what's you and not you? How do you center within your own self? And I try to, so that it's interesting to more advanced practitioners, I've put sort of an underworld or a Hades spin on most things, right? So the chapter in particular where we talk about like boundaries and warding is a little known piece of mythology where Hades is actually injured by an arrow. He's injured by an arrow that's shot by Heracles or Hercules, as his name is often pronounced. And Hades has to go to Olympus to get a healer to pull the arrow out. And in that chapter, I sort of, I talk about like how do you keep stray arrows from hitting you, like those energetic kind of stray arrows. So again, just kind of making the connections so that you can think about the magical operations sort of as applied to Hades in the underworld.
That's really good. Yes, and you do throughout your book, you do something called best practices, where you
Yeah.
give tips and tricks and help lead people in order to take what they've learned in order to do it themselves.
Yeah. I believe that everyone is their own best spiritual authority. My hope is that the information will empower people to build their own practice and then to really customize it for themselves. Yeah. I don't want people to do things just because I said to.
Yeah, it is fun. You also talk about doing shadow work and the shadow. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that is some deep and powerful magic. I know many
It
people are
is.
familiar with the concept of the shadow or shadow work itself, but if you're
But I
not
think
familiar,
shadow with Hades is a little bit different. It has a different take.
yeah, it is. Shadow work with Hades is very interesting because a lot of times I think that there is a tendency to think that if something's in shadow, it means that it's undesirable or that we need to get
Or
rid of it or
bad,
that we need to fix it. Yeah, that it has a negative connotation. And working with Hades, it's very interesting because something he always is very curious about is what people truly desire. Like not just what they say they want on the surface, but like really what kind of is driving that, what desires lie hidden in perhaps like the shadowy or the unseen parts of their personality. And so Hades can really help sort of draw that out. And, because he is not, Hades is, he's a paradox himself, right? He has sort of, he's sacred and profane. He's got some incredibly amazing, wonderful traits, and then there are also bits of mythology that are difficult, So he's kind of like us, he's
Perfect.
not perfect. And so I think when you're working with shadow and you're trying to draw out that desire and you're trying to figure out how you can actually incorporate all these important parts of yourself, he can really help with that. It's like you don't have to cast out things that you feel are not acceptable to the rest of the world. Hades can kind of help you really find like the riches and the power that's in that and help you do a perspective shift, so that you can either draw those desires out and experience them and be fully alive, or if it's something that you're not necessarily, that fond of, do a perspective shift and like, how can we kind of reframe this and use it in a healthy way? We don't have to cut parts of ourselves out to do
And don't you think because he's not one-sided or he's all perfect or all sunshine and rainbows, that makes him more approachable? and
Oh, yeah.
for people and more realistic.
Yeah,
Especially
absolutely.
in this time. Yeah.
Yeah, he's very pragmatic. And, because he is the host of the Realm of the Dead, he's
Right.
seen everything.
Right.
He's seen everything that could possibly happen in the scope of human experience. So, I think that he is very rarely, if ever, surprised by anything.
You also do a good job, which I hadn't thought of. For me, probably like a lot of other people, Hades was someone to be afraid of, that he came and got you at death. He was, and you say that is not accurate.
It's interesting. So even to this day, there's like a belief that, oh, you shouldn't work with Hades because if you do work with Hades or you pay too much
You're
attention to
inviting
him,
death.
yeah, you're
Right.
drawing death near to you.
Right.
And this, in the ancient world, this was a form of protective magic, right? Like we don't talk about
Right.
Hades. We call him, like,
Right.
there's euphemisms. We call him the wealthy one or the notorious
Right.
one or some other kind of thing. We don't actually
Right.
even say the name.
Right.
And and this kind of persists, like even to this day, this idea of not wanting to draw
Right.
him near. So that's really, really interesting. And a lot of there's misconceptions that come out of that, right? Like sometimes people think that Hades is the being that comes for you at the end of your life, but it's
Right.
actually not. In Greek mythology, it's Thanatos, which
Right.
is Thanatos is a di is a day is a daemon. So that's where we get
Right.
the word demon, but it's not like a
Right.
demon like in the Bible.
A
A
Christian demon,
diamond,
right.
yeah, it's like kind of a being that's not a god, not a human, kind of like an in-betweener, right?
Right.
And Thanatos is basically death, when death comes to get you. Hades isn't even really in charge of when you die. That's the fates that
Right.
decide
I
that.
didn't
So
realize that really until I read your book, because I think I had a lot of misconceptions like a lot of other people.
yeah, the Morai or the trio of fates are the ones that kind of spin out the days of your life. There's like a spinning and weaving
Right.
metaphor. And
Right.
at the end of it, there's a sharp pair of scissors that that one
There
of
you
the
go.
fates, Atropos, like uses to cut the thread of your life. And that's when Thanatos will come and collect your soul. And also in the ancient Greeks belief system, they believed in the transmigration of the soul. So when you die, you don't stay dead. You will be reborn, like you will enter the cycle
Right.
again. But when you are between lifetimes, you do live within Hades' realm, within the underworld.
Right. Right. Yeah. So again, I think there's a lot of I'm sure I'm not the only one who had misconceptions. And so I learned a lot. And it's funny, we talked about death in a mythological sense, but your book does a really good job talking about having a good death and things that you can do. Tell us about that. I thought that was really good.
Thanks.
Mundane things that you should probably really think about, that like other people, that people don't want to think about, because again, I think there's this unconscious thing that you're going to draw death if you talk about it.
Yeah, we modern society is, well, and I'm speaking again from a Westerner's perspective, living in North America, that we're very death phobic. And we don't see death very much, right? Like even when we go to the grocery store to buy food, it's prepackaged in plastic, right? We don't have to, most of us don't have to butcher an animal or even harvest a plant to eat it. We avoid talking about death and we avoid planning for our own deaths. And that's something that can be very important, not only for you, it can be really empowering for you as a person, but it's really important for those that you leave behind.
Absolutely.
Because when you're dead, you're on to whatever the next thing is, right? You're
Right.
exploring your new territory. But there are some people that will be left behind that need to deal with sort of your wishes of how to put this mortal lifetime to rest. And so
Right.
there are certain things, that we can do to make that easier on those who may be who love us or may be dealing with sorting us out.
You also talk about ground markers and taking care of areas, and which again, I had never really associated. And again, you tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Yeah. So we're just talking about some of the sort of devotional activities, like not really magical activities per se, but devotional activities. If you want to devote some of your time to Hades and things that that resonate with him. And I think you're talking about taking care of places of the dead, like cemeteries and graveyards.
Right. Which I didn't think about. And you're right. That would be a really good offering to something that you could do to get in touch.
Yeah, it's like a very physical offering to do that. And, you know, and also, you know, it's just, again, like if you want to get to know like the energy of Hades, the energy of the underworld, like you can't really do that without interacting with death.
Right.
You can't really do that. So, and that's not going to be for everyone, and that's okay. Right. But I think that for those of us who feel called to this type of work, there is really important for society to have people that have emotional, spiritual, mental intelligence around death, right?
Absolutely.
It's important. We need those folks, right? And I think that if you're also looking to have like a magical practice or a devotional practice that, you know, ties in with your calling to work with death and dying, Hades is there. The underworld is there, right?
Absolutely. So has he, I'm sure in a trance work, you told him about your book. What does he think?
Oh, I mean, he basically is the co-author, it could say, by Jamie Wagner and Hades.
Hades as Toad by Jamie. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly. Funny. I'm kind of like the ghostwriter, right?
Yeah. But I do not think there's a lot of books on that subject. So he has got to be very, very pleased. So
I think he is pleased. I think it's interesting because he has spent millennia being largely behind the scenes with some exceptions of how he's in pop culture because he's, you know, a popular character. But he is, you know, I often think about this. He has chosen to come forward like with me and be in my life and, you know, I feel like this book contract and the process of writing it and publishing it came with such great ease. It really feels very synchronistic. Like it was something that he had put his own energy into the background of all the networking that needed to happen to make this a reality. And so he's chosen to come forward and share these things. You know, I tend to think, I mean, we're at a very tumultuous point in the world. We have multiple wars going on. We are, I mean, some say the pandemic is over. I don't think I would say that. We're dealing with sort of ongoing pandemic and its after effects. We're dealing with a lot of cultural shifts, a lot of political divides. We have all kinds of things that are happening. There is, you know, because when you talk about death and dying, I mean, there's a lot of things that are transitioning, right? As like old ideas die, new ideas are born, things shift. And so it makes sense to me that he's like, that he would step forward at a time when all of this is happening, like climate chaos and everything else.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that that's probably, one of the reasons it might be behind the fact that he, you know, wants to come forward and be a little bit more known to us at this time.
Well, your book was excellent. Thank you very much. And I think our listeners will really enjoy it. I know they can get it at Llewellyn.com, which has a big place in our hearts. We're huge Llewellyn fans at Circle Sanctuary, but you can also get it online. And I always say, go to a local bookstore if you can have it and request it.
Yeah.
And
there's if you don't have a local bookseller near you, there's also a website called bookshop.org, and you can request it through there. And what they do is they actually they source from local booksellers, so it's kind of an online way of sourcing it. Yeah.
Oh, good.
I always tell people, like, number one, do your local bookseller. Number two, go through Llewellyn. If you need to go through Amazon, it's on Amazon. And there is actually a Kindle and an audiobook version available.
I was just going to ask
Amazon.
You about an audiobook because I know many people who I'm like, they don't read anymore. They like audiobooks. So do you like a Kindle? I just cannot. I'm old and I cannot. My daughter, I don't know that she has any books anymore in her house. She has 1,000 books on Kindle, and I'm old school. I like the feel of a book. So
I do. I like the way they smell, the way they feel. So when I'm researching or when I'm at home, I have like physical copies of books whenever possible. I do have a Kindle library, and I do take Kindle with me like when I'm traveling, because I do find myself traveling quite often, and I just don't want to lug around a full suitcase of books.
I will agree. I'm really bad though about and I do too. I travel a lot, is I have many books that I've read on Kindle and then I purchase the book. So I actually have the book because I just cannot warm up
That's nice.
to yeah, I cannot seem to warm up that much. But audiobooks I do like, and so I do know a lot of people who are big audiobook nerds. So I'm sure our listeners
Yeah,
will like that
and
and they'll be able to get that.
if you listen to the audio also, you can hear all the Greek words pronounced, right? You can hear all the names and all the words, and that really helps as well.
You're laughing, but you did several names tonight, and I'm like, that's how you say that. Absolutely. I go on Google Pronounce quite a bit because I'm like, what? So, absolutely. So, that is great.
Well,
So, can you give a
yeah,
hint
I
of your
tried.
next project? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I try to always work on my pronunciation. I feel like it's my duty to be respectful and try to
Right.
get it as right as I possibly can for the people that took care of these stories for so long. And I'm always correcting myself. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I got that one wrong. And
Right.
usually I'll just come out like on my social media or
Right.
something and say, well, I was saying this, but I learned that you say it this way,
Right.
because we're all in progress. So for me, the next book that I want to write is going to be a little it's actually, it can be read independently of Hades, but it's in some ways a sequel. There are so many There's so many beings that dwell in the underworld. I barely got to scratch the surface of how rich
Right.
the underworld is and what it has to offer. So I'd like to go into more depth and detail with some of the specific different beings that are down there, how to get to know them, what their correspondences are, why you might want to work with them. And I also want to get a little bit more into the topic of what I call death priestessing, which is what we talked about, the sort of the idea of being the
The
person that
death
can be like
midwife, right.
the midwife that kind of helps with those transitions. So I want to go into some more specifics about that. I actually do teach a course. I'm teaching it right now
Oh.
on death priestessing. We're in the middle of it. It actually goes through April. So I do have like a lot of material that I want to, incorporate that for the next one. So it's almost, in my mind, I'm almost kind of envisioning it as a like an underworld book of shadows almost, with just kind of more techniques and more information.
So, is your classes you teach, is that something you do annually, or how often
Yeah,
do you do
so
that?
I have a collaboration with a good friend of mine named Murphy, and our little teaching school is called Way of the Weaver because it weaves together many different threads. It's
Right.
not a specific tradition, but it is very focused on community and social justice and like responsible ethical magic. And we teach a lot of different things. Excuse me, we usually teach one online class every year. It rotates topics. Right now we're teaching death priestessing. In the past, we've taught, we have a course called Divination for Liberation. We teach about divination methods. We teach a radical devotion class about how to
Oh.
d develop relationships with deities.
Right.
We teach a like ethical spell crafting class, sort of with the mechanics of like how to do spells and what the ethical considerations are. So we teach a lot of different topics. The one thing I did want to mention is if your listeners or you are anywhere near Vermont in the summertime, we do a summer camp. We have what we call Weaver Camp,
Oh.
and it's out. Murphy actually lives on the side of a mountain, so it's on Murphy's property,
Oh,
and
that's nice.
yeah, it's pretty cool. And so it's like great food, great friends, great fun. We do some teaching and swimming in swimming holes during the day, and then we do ritual at night.
Well,
So
that's fun.
yeah, it's really fun. Weaver Camp this year is coming up in June. It's June 27th through the 30th. And if you go to either my website or you can go to wayoftheweaver.com, you can find some more info about that. So that program's really fun. And we also have a podcast. We release two episodes a month, and you can just go
Right.
and listen to Jamie and Murphy chat about magic.
Oh, that's great. And so is your podcast is probably like ours on Spotify and Apple and
anywhere
everywhere
you,
else.
it's just
And
Way
the
of the
name of it
Weaver.
is Web of the Weaver.
Way of the Weaver.
Way of the Weaver. Okay. All
Yep.
right. I
And
will
it's
do
just
that.
in,
Yeah.
it's in all the podcatchers have it.
Oh, that's good. I'm a podcast girl myself because, like I said, I travel a lot and that's just easy and fun and contained. And so I love podcasts. So, all right. Great.
Usually, in one episode a month, we do like a tarot forecast for the year. So, and in one episode, we talk about kind of the cards we drew for the month and sort of what's going on and how that's working out. And then the other episode is usually more topical. So we'll, pick whatever topic that we decide to chat about, like ritual or something else, spell casting or whatnot. So it's fun. It's very informal.
Oh, I will definitely listen. So, thank you so much. You have been delightful. And
Oh,
you are welcome
thank
anytime. And please come back when you write your next book or you have another project you want to talk about. Please come back. I really, really enjoyed your book, and I know our listeners will.
Oh, thank you so much, Deborah. I really do appreciate it, and I very much enjoy speaking with you as well.
Well, and remember, everyone, Jamie's newest book is Hades, Myth, Magic, and Devotion. And as we said, you can get it at your local bookstore, ask for it. You can and also go to Llewellyn.com. I'd like to thank Stephen, our sound engineer, for his technical expertise. And I'd like to thank all of you out there, our listeners, for your continued support of all of our shows here on Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast, or CSNP. Join us again on Tuesday, April 2nd, for a show all about dragons. We're going to be chatting with author Virginia Chandler about her new book, Seeking Dragons. I look forward to being with all of you again, so please come back. Good night, everyone, and blessed be.
Thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow nature-centered paths. Join us throughout the week for various programming connecting with the community around the world. Please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSN Podcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. Until next time, many blessings.